Under the Golden Dome is supported by the Iowa Bankers Association. Bankers across Iowa are ready to help Iowans reach their financial goals to get them where they want to go. Learn about the difference of Iowa banks by following Iowa Bankers on Facebook and Twitter.
From Iowa Public Radio News, this is Under the Golden Dome, a podcast about the Iowa legislature. I'm John Pimble.
Chair recognizes the lady from Sierra Gordo, Representative Upmeyer.
It's not very often the Speaker of the House, Linda Upmeyer, addresses the chamber from her desk.
Mr. Speaker, would I be in order for a point of personal privilege?
Madam Speaker, you are in order.
Upmeyer only uses her empty chamber floor desk to vote when someone else is presiding. But today she's doing what many other legislators do during the year. She makes a point of personal privilege.
It's been a long time since I've given any speech from this chair or even the chair back there. So I'm a little nervous about this, but I had something going on that I thought you all might be interested in.
She talks about the national television show American Idol. It's a weekly competition where unknown singers perform in front of celebrity pop music judges. Television viewers vote which artists come back and which do not by calling or using an app. One of the new contestants is a 20-year-old from Iowa.
A young lady from Clarksville, Iowa, is on American Idol. Maddie Poppy. She is an amazing young lady and very talented. So I would like us all to download the app for American Idol and watch her as she performs these next couple weeks on television and all help a young lady from Iowa be very successful just by voting on our apps.
Maddie Poppy is still in the running on American Idol, but very soon there won't be an opportunity for legislators to talk about her television appearance on the chamber floor. April 17th is the 100th day of the 2018 session, the last day for legislators to receive per diem expenses. It's always the goal of the legislature to be done by this time, but before they go this year, they have to approve next year's budget and decide what changes they want to make to Iowa's tax code. There are two very different tax plans. One comes from the Senate, which passed last month. It proposes hundreds of millions of dollars to be removed from next year's revenue and would eventually reduce it by $1 billion per year. The House's version is based on the governor's proposal. It is not as aggressive as the Senate's and would eventually reduce taxes by $300 million a year. There was a public hearing for the House bill early this week. It's before the House Ways and Means Committee, where almost three dozen people spoke. Executive Director of the Iowa Policy Project, Mike Owen, opposes because it reduces too much revenue.
At a time when, as you all know, you have been facing mid-year budget cuts. This violates a basic principle about taxes, and that is revenue adequacy. The budget that you folks put together was not supported by our tax system as it was.
Helen Pierce, Cedar Falls Community Credit Union CEO, does not want the House bill to include new taxes on credit unions, something only in the Senate version of the bill.
The Senate tax reform bill included a tax on 20 credit unions who serve 600,000 members, including mine. I urge the House to reject the Senate language. Under the Senate bill, our credit union will be taxed about 50% more, and that is not tax relief. Unfortunately, this means that our members may pay more for their car loans and their home loans.
But CEO of Union State Bank, Peg Scott, argues banks like hers in Greenfield are smaller than some credit unions and wants credit unions taxed more.
Credit unions are using their government advantage to solicit deposits statewide in rural communities where they have no locations within 100 miles of these communities. They then use these high net worth deposits from rural Iowa to fund loans to high income areas such as West Des Moines and Iowa City.
Part of the House bill is to put a sales tax on taxis. Carolyn Jennison represents taxi companies in the Des Moines area.
The cab company provides on average nearly 1,900 trips a week for elderly, disadvantaged, and differently abled Iowans. For many of these at-risk Iowans, a taxicab is their primary source of transportation to the grocery store, to doctor's appointments, and to work. A sales tax on taxicabs is in reality a tax on the elderly, poor, and differently abled.
This sales tax also applies to rideshare companies like Lyft and Uber. Lobbyist for Uber Matt Ady says this would be a new tax for Iowa.
There's only been a handful of states in the country that have applied a state sales tax, and Iowa will be an outlier around the country for this service.
Jen Kingland lobbies for the Iowa Taxpayers Association and says this plan is a step forward to stimulate economic growth.
Now that the federal government has passed the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, Iowa needs to act now to reform its own state tax code. With no action, many Iowans and Iowa businesses will see an increase in the amount of state income taxes they will owe for the year 2018, which could further hamper Iowa's economic growth.
And West Des Moines resident Gary Leffler says he is benefiting from the federal tax changes that started in January and wants tax changes on the state level as well.
The way I look at it, the federal government said, you know what, according to one of the government officials, the federal government has given us crumbs. I look at what the state of Iowa is doing here to cut our taxes. I said, you know what, I appreciate what you're doing. You're putting a little gravy on my taters. I told my wife the other day, I says, look, if we keep getting crumbs from the federal government and the state of Iowa keeps putting a little gravy on our taters, pretty soon we're going to have enough to go out and get a meal. It's going to be a good deal for the state of Iowa.
A couple of days after this public hearing, Republican House leaders announced some changes to their tax plan. Representative Pete County says the plan is now designed to reduce $1.3 billion in tax over the next 5 years.
This bill also does a couple other things. It raises the standard deduction, which will be another very meaningful piece for middle-class Iowans that will help all of them. It nearly doubles it for both the single and a married couple. And perhaps most importantly for what we do, this bill lives within the means of state government based on the REC estimates for the tax year 2019 and 2020. So we're very thrilled with the product that we will consider here in the near future.
The REC is the Revenue Estimated Conference, which projects how much money the state could receive in the future. Representative Guy Vanderlinden says, unlike the Senate version, the House bill does not eliminate federal deductibility.
Because we're being responsible about the revenue, and we think that that is something that we can't do right now.
You said all along that if you didn't do that, then Iowans would not benefit from the federal tax break. Are you not, is something alleviated your concern about that?
No, Iowans will benefit from it, and it's a matter of how you adjust the rates and make sure that they get the complete federal tax deduction, that they don't end up with an increase in their Iowa state tax.
This bill also proposes sales taxes for online purchases, including downloaded books and streaming of music and video through places like iTunes or Netflix. Thursday, during a Ways and Means House Committee meeting to discuss the latest version of the tax bill, Representative Pete County says the general fund revenue impact for 2019 will be $98 million, and in 2020, it will be $197 million. Much of this comes from income tax cuts. Representative Todd Pritchard questions Representative County as to how the state can afford this.
How are we going to get to a balanced budget with a revenue loss of $196.8 million, given the fact we've taken $130 million from the cash reserve fund, $13 million from the Economic Emergency Fund, on top of the fact that we have deappropriated this year and last year? How do we get back to a balanced budget? Because we are, by those numbers, decreasing net revenue. I don't see how we balance the budget when we are in debt, but then we are going to decrease revenue. How do we catch up? How do we pay back to where we get back to zero balance, zero owed to cash reserve and economic emergency fund? How do we do that given the fact that we are decreasing revenues by 196?
I mean, I would say, you call it decreasing revenues, I say we're giving Iowans tax relief. They're getting dollars. And that's really important to a lot of all of our constituents. So the decrease in revenue is one way to put it. I call this tax relief for hardworking Iowans. That being said, these numbers are based off REC estimates that we have to work off of, and it leaves an ending balance.
I told myself I don't want to, you know, this is a ways and means issue. Obviously everything works together with appropriations and all that, but I do like to stick to the ways and means portion of it as much as possible.
The House and the Senate's tax bill are both around 100 pages. The House tax plan will likely go on the floor for debate on Monday. The Senate did pass a tax plan last month, but now they are revising it. Right now, it would cut income taxes by 8%. The House plan cuts it by 9%. The Senate plan reduces corporate income taxes. The House does not. Under the Senate plan, tax reduction would be $2 billion over 5 years. The House would be $1.3 billion. House and Ways Committee member Dave Jacoby says he doesn't understand how any of this can be considered when budget projections for fiscal year 2019, which starts in 3.5 months, aren't available yet.
So it's a little disappointing that 3 days left in the session, you drop a major amendment on a major tax reform bill and expect to hurry it through. With all due respect, I think everyone that works inside the hallowed halls knows that it's mainly a pissing match between Senate Republicans and House Republicans.
Senate leaders say they are negotiating with the House leaders and the governor to figure out the right plan. It's likely both will have to make compromises. Senate leaders say this process is likely to take 5 to 10 days, which is a strong sign the legislature will not adjourn on Tuesday. This is Under the Golden Dome, a weekly legislative podcast. I'm John Pimble. Recently, President Donald Trump announced he wants to place tariffs on metal going to China. China has responded with intentions to place tariffs on products from the United States. Pork and soybeans are among the exports to China, and that would affect Iowa. Governor Kim Reynolds has expressed reservations about President Trump's tariffs, and this week holds a press conference with members from the agriculture industry.
Trade is absolutely critical for a healthy Iowa economy. $13.2 billion in Iowa goods were exported in 2017, and you've often heard me say that one in five jobs is dependent upon trade.
The governor says Iowa is benefiting from a long-standing relationship with China.
The ties between Iowa farmers and China also continue to grow. So that's why escalation of tariffs around the world is concerning, and the potential Chinese tariffs produce real issues. As you know, farmers tend to be early targets in trade disputes, and the markets have reflected that uncertainty. The potential damage to export markets comes at a difficult time for agriculture and our economy, with depressed commodity prices again adding uncertainty for farmers as we head into the 2018 season.
In March, President Trump said trade wars are good and easy to win.
But no one wins in a trade war. And while some disruption may be necessary and part of the negotiation process, we know that this absolutely can't be done on the backs of Iowa farmers. It's important that we find a reasonable agreement and make sure that it's targeted and done in a timely manner, which will also help mitigate the risk of us losing market share. So let me review quickly the timeline that's taken place already. March 23rd, the U.S. placed 25% tariff on imported steel and 10% on imported aluminum. In response, China placed retaliatory tariffs of 15 to 25% on 128 U.S. products, including pork. April 3rd, the U.S. released a list of $50 billion worth of Chinese imports that would face a 25% tariff. And on April 4th, China says it will place an additional 25% tariffs on over 100 U.S. goods, including soybeans, beef, corn, and ethanol. April 5th, President Trump instructed the USTR rep to consider if $100 billion of additional tariffs would be appropriate. Now, the last three that I just listed, the proposed tariffs, have not gone into effect yet and won't for at least 60 days. I had the opportunity yesterday to speak to Ambassador Branstad, and he wanted me to assure everyone that they are working every day for a positive outcome for our country, agriculture, and American businesses.
Bill Shipley from the Iowa Soybean Association says relations with China matter to U.S. soybean farmers.
They're our largest consumer of soybeans. The United States supplies roughly 40% of China's annual usage of soybeans, valued at over $14 billion, which is anticipated to grow every year for the next several years. We recognize that there are some legitimate issues that need to be dealt with the Chinese. Intellectual property rights and requirements on U.S. companies wanting to do business in China. We acknowledge that there needs to be addressed and these courageous, swift resolution to these problems. We believe this can be done without targeting food and agricultural trade. Exports of U.S. soybeans, beef, pork, and other commodities provides a trade surplus for our country. Encouraging more of it is advantageous for both countries.
On Wednesday, Sam Clovis returned to his Iowa home for a vacation. Clovis is the senior White House advisor to the United States Department of Agriculture. He was a guest for a conservative breakfast club in Urbandale. During his speech, he talks about the tension with China and says despite some of the downturns on the markets, it's important for Iowans to remain calm.
It's hard. I know it's hard. But I think they also need to be patient because he's not going to sell the country down the river. He's not.
Clovis says there are trade imbalances with China.
And that's what we're trying to fix. You know, a lot of people talk about the fact that, you know, that we're about to enter a trade war. Well, I would say that we've probably been in a trade war for 40 years. And we're just starting our mounting our counterattack. So I think that this is the issue that we're starting with.
In the Senate, during points of personal privilege where a senator can address the body about a topic of their choosing, Senator Rita Hart speaks about the potential effects of new tariffs.
Many of us here in the chamber are farmers, and all of us represent a state that's tied closely to the farm economy. Most experts agree that Iowa and Iowa's farmers will be big losers if the United States actually gets into a trade war. And Iowa farmers have already had several years of low prices, as we know. So a trade war, even a short one, could mean long-term losses. That's because other countries will quickly replace Iowa's agricultural products. So I've written a letter to President Trump, and I've stated those concerns, and I would really like it if all of us could sign that letter.
The one-page letter ends with this paragraph. We urge you, Mr. President, to reconsider this strategy because of the negative consequences on Iowans who farm, those who live in rural communities, and those whose livelihoods depend on products whose markets are threatened by a trade war with China. Other senators, like Tim Kapoutsian, a farmer, says market prices now are better than they were 1 year ago.
I think we need to hang tough with the president. Somebody's actually stood up against somebody that's been taking advantage of us for far too long. Somebody that's been stealing our technology. Somebody that's been putting trade import tariffs on us. We're supposed to take their stuff, but boy, we're going to charge you when you bring yours over. We need to stand strong here. We don't need to weaken his position.
Senator Brad Zahn says he has no intention of signing the letter, and while he doesn't specifically say this letter is disrespectful,
the lack of respect for our current president makes me sick. I was raised, no matter who the president is, that we respect that person. I'm amazed at what is being said about him. Here's what I do know, is that everything that he's doing, he said he would do it during the campaign. I know that's probably new to most politicians, but he's actually fallen through with what he said he'd do.
From there, the points of privilege escalate to harsh attacks on the president, like this from Senator Rob Hoeg.
You know, you can be tough on trade without being erratic in instituting trade wars. That costs a lot of people a lot of wealth. He's erratic. It needs to stop.
Independent Senator David Johnson, a former Republican who left the party after President Trump became the National Party's candidate, says some farmers may go out of business because of the president's actions.
When I go home and I talk to the people, I like to call them dirt farmers sometimes, because they're struggling. They are struggling. They have for 2 or 3 years, and then you're hit with this. We need a civic lesson here, and it should be in bipartisanship. or of course tripartisanship, but I'm happy to sign on to that letter. Thank you for taking that. Shame on the Republicans if what Senator Zahn represents that caucus. And go on laughing, Senator Schultz. You know, keep ripping apart the state and its unions and everything, okay?
Point of order. Point of order has been called, Senator Chalgren.
I'm not trying to set a record, Mr. President.
Senator Chalgren, will you please state your point?
Senator Johnson's being an idiot. I'd ask him to stop, please.
Senator Chalgren, Senator D. Johnson, please approach the well.
During this General Assembly, Senator David Johnson often harshly criticizes Republicans and argues with Senator Mark Chalgren on the floor. The senators return to their desk after a conference with the Senate president.
The chair recognizes Senator Chalgren.
Thank you, Mr. President. Let me clarify. It was inappropriate for me to say that Senator Johnson is an idiot. What I should have said was that
Senator Chalgren, will you please approach the well?
It's not too often a senator is immediately called back to the well, but insults on the floor like this likely violate the Senate's rule of decorum. When Chalgren returns to his desk,
Senator Chalgren.
Thank you, Mr. President. I'll clarify. My apologies to Senator Johnson for calling him an idiot. Thank you.
After this exchange, Senator Liz Mathis speaks.
I am standing in defense of Senator Hart's letter. How did we get so far away from the letter? Lots of mansplaining going on out here. Listen, I got to tell you, did Senator Zahn isn't in his seat. Did he read the letter?
Senator Jason Schultz says he didn't receive a copy of the letter, and it's possible others didn't as well.
I'm not about to sign the letter, but I would like to see what's in it. And if a mistake was made, I'm not holding anybody to account for it. I just want to let you know we didn't. I mean, it's not a gotcha. It's not a nothing. I didn't get it. I'd be interested to read it. I will not sign it. And the reason I won't sign it is because I'm personally disappointed, and I will share the same style of shock that how could you ever. There have been times we could stand up for Iowa. There have been times when we could say that, hey, the people of Iowa don't need this to happen to them, but we didn't see a similar type of sudden defense. And in this case, I think the letter is inappropriate. That's why I'm not going to let, I mean, I'll just be open and honest with that. And I guess I'll echo some of what our other ag senators have said. See, going into this situation, and I'd like to hold myself to be a free trader, not a tariff supporter, and I'm not looking forward to going through this. And yet, at the same time, we need to realize that China is annually 500, and I had one gentleman mention $560 billion ahead of us constantly by doing what we're doing. And that is Republican and Democratic presidents combined. Nobody has stood up to the system, to the people who are gaining advantage at our expense. I am excited that somebody is standing up and saying that we're done taking it.
Senator Rita Hart apologizes for the oversight in not making sure all senators received the letter. She is also the last senator to speak for the day, and while this isn't a structured debate about a bill, these points of personal privilege turned into a debate about the president.
We're here to hammer things out, right? To have disagreements and to talk about things so that we come away after listening to someone who doesn't think the same way we do naturally, that we come away learning something and perhaps coming away with better policy. And so I guess I have trouble with the word that you used, Senator Schultz, of inappropriate. And we could talk about that, but my intention in this letter is not to be disrespectful to the president. The whole point of this is that we need to stick up for Iowa. We need to have a conversation about what's good for Iowa. Senator Kapotzian, I appreciate your comments. We obviously, you know, are looking at this a little bit differently, but we all want to stick up for what's best for Iowa, and we should be able to have that conversation without digressing into this personal tirade on one side or the other of the person that happens to occupy the Oval Office.
The next morning, Governor Kim Reynolds is in Washington, D.C. At the White House, she is one of a couple dozen governors and congressional leaders to have a roundtable discussion about agriculture with President Trump. After the meeting, she issues a written statement saying, "The president listened to our concerns, said that he is determined to resolve the dispute with China, said that he intends to expand E-15, and ordered his top advisors to study the possibility of re-entering the TPP. The TPP is the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a trade agreement 12 countries signed in 2016. However, the United States withdrew in early 2017. This is Under the Golden Dome, a legislative podcast from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm John Pimble.
Under the Golden Dome is supported by the Iowa Bankers Association. Bankers across Iowa are ready to help Iowans reach their financial goals to get them where they want to go. Learn about the difference of Iowa banks by following Iowa Bankers on Facebook and Twitter.
Iowa does not have a lieutenant governor. Adam Gregg is technically the acting lieutenant governor. Last year, Kim Reynolds became the governor after Terry Branstad resigned to be the ambassador to China. She named Adam Gregg as her lieutenant governor, but the attorney general wrote a legal opinion stating Reynolds could not appoint a lieutenant governor. In order to resolve the legality, Reynolds officially named Gregg as acting lieutenant governor. Adam Gregg is not in line to become the governor if Reynolds were to leave the office today. That role would fall to Senate President Charles Schneider. A priority for legislators this year is to clarify the power of the governor in this matter. The best route is to amend the state constitution. Enter Senate Joint Resolution 2006. It passed the Senate, but now comes before the House, floor managed by Representative Chip Baltimore. Representative Baltimore says last year's Attorney General 23-page opinion was unexpected.
He basically came to the conclusion that when the lieutenant governor becomes the governor after a vacancy in the office of the governor, there is no lieutenant, well, actually the new governor is also the lieutenant governor at the same time and did not have the power to appoint a new lieutenant governor. So this amendment, or this resolution, would seek an amendment to the Constitution to clarify, to the extent that it needs clarifying, although some of us don't think that it does, clarifies the constitutional language to make it clear that when there is a vacancy in the office of governor, the lieutenant governor becomes the governor, and the then governor has the power to appoint a new lieutenant governor.
Baltimore says the resolution also clarifies language about what to do if the governor vacates an office, but then comes back.
When the vacancy occurs, the lieutenant governor becomes governor. He or she can appoint a lieutenant governor, but if the old governor that vacated the office for a period of time comes back after the disability is removed, that person would once again become governor. The lieutenant governor that became governor would go back to the lieutenant governor position, and the appointed lieutenant governor would be out of office.
Representative Sharon Steckman offers an amendment.
My amendment simply adds to this resolution by making sure that the lieutenant governor that is chosen is confirmed by the Senate and the House. This procedure is done in the U.S. Constitution. The Constitutional Amendment, 25th Amendment, was put in place for this very purpose. The House and the Senate together must ratify the appointment. If the president appoints a vice president, the House and the Senate must ratify that appointment. And so I really feel there needs to be some checks and balances, because there is nothing qualifying that lieutenant governor that the governor appoints. The person has not been elected by the state. And this way, people that are elected by the state would have a chance to weigh in and confirm their appointment.
Steckman says right now the Iowa Senate has to confirm governor's appointments, and when appointing the lieutenant governor, a similar standard should apply. Representative Baltimore says confirmation should not be a requirement.
Not only is the confirmation process for the appointment of lieutenant governor not supported by the text of the Iowa Constitution or the text of the Iowa Code, in fact, the exact opposite is laid out, that the appointment is permitted by the Constitution and the Code without confirmation. I also am not a fan or supportive of a concept that allows partisan bodies to make up qualifications that do not exist. I would imagine that there were several members of this body that were quite upset when Supreme Court Justice Scalia passed away and President Obama appointed or nominated a candidate, a nominee to fill a position on the United States Supreme Court, and the United States Senate Judiciary Committee delayed the confirmation process until after the election. And I would imagine, and I've heard a number of people at the time argue to me that that was partisan in nature, that the confirmation process at that point in time became so partisan that it wasn't constitutional, it wasn't right. I have seen in this building confirmation processes for lower officials, department heads, agency heads, over in the Iowa Senate become partisan and political. And I've heard the rhetoric in this chamber, outside this chamber, about the partisanship and the increasingly heightened partisanship about who's qualified and who's not qualified to serve. I have witnessed myself a number of people in this very chamber who won't even have their picture taken in the speaker's chair except at an angle so that the President of the United States, who was elected by the people, doesn't show up in the picture.
Please state your point.
We learned how to take those pictures from you. Thank you.
Representative Dave Jacoby refers to when President Obama's picture was in the chamber when some Republicans angled a camera to avoid having Obama's face in the picture. A portrait of the President of the United States is always in the House chamber just behind the Speaker of the House's chair. It's a place where many legislators and visitors have their picture taken. Jacoby and Baltimore approached the Speaker as well for 5 minutes. The Speaker rules Jacoby's point as not well taken. Upon returning, Representative Baltimore takes a shot at Jacoby.
Took us 5 minutes on a point of order on something that was allegedly not even a point of order, but because somebody was upset. Again, my point is that don't think for a second, in my opinion, that the partisanship of the bodies when it comes to a confirmation process would not be used to the partisan advantage of someone else. In my opinion, and my opinion is based on what I have observed and what I hear, and the sometimes, very oftentimes, public statements of members of this body and members of the body across the chamber. I think Iowa deserves better than the partisanship that we've been hearing lately, and I think Iowans deserve better than the partisanship that can be displayed, and I fear would be displayed, through a confirmation process in which delay in the confirmation process could, in fact, lead to a change of political party of the governor's office.
This amendment fails. As the discussion for the resolution continues, Representative Mary Wolf opposes because it lacks a confirmation by the House and Senate.
I don't understand the resistance on the part of the majority party in stepping up, accepting some responsibility for exerting a small amount of oversight on such an incredibly important decision. And yes, the vast majority of the time, lieutenant governors stay lieutenant governors and do whatever it is that the governor tells them to do. But as we have all seen occasionally the lieutenant governor becomes governor. And that comes with a whole lot of power. And why we would be willing to cede any oversight of the people, because that's when we apply oversight, we are applying it on behalf of the people of Iowa, who are not going to have a chance to vet this potential lieutenant governor in an election as they normally would. So at least we need to give them the opportunity to vet the potential lieutenant governor through their elected representatives.
In closing arguments, Representative Baltimore says this resolution will officially clarify a line of succession structure he says that has already been in place for decades.
This simply clarifies existing code, existing constitutional provisions, and what everyone, I shouldn't say everyone, what many, many, many people believed would be the case. I do appreciate the gravity of what this resolution does. It is consistent with what the wise founders of our state believed at the time when they laid out Article 4, Section 10 of the Constitution that gave the governor the power to appoint or fill a vacancy by commission, which is just an appointment, without a confirmation process. I will even defer to the wisdom of the unanimous House and the unanimous Senate and a governor in 2009 that put the same thing into code. This is consistent, ladies and gentlemen. It's what Iowans wanted and have wanted forever, apparently until today, according to some. This is a good resolution. It clarifies a situation that I don't think needed clarified, but others did.
The resolution passes the House. Since it has been amended, it needs to go back to the Senate. If it passes there, it has to be passed again during the next General Assembly, then be voted on by the public before it can be part of the state constitution. During this debate, a central argument Democrats make is the lack of chamber confirmation for an appointed lieutenant governor. This is the process for all the appointed offices the governor now makes. It only requires Senate confirmation. This is for offices like the Department of Human Services or the Racing and Gaming Commission. There are hundreds of these positions requiring Senate confirmation, and most of them happen in bulk. Through the session, senators take large blocks of these names and vote on them at once. But some appointments are voted on individually. This was the case for the Department of Human Services Director Jerry Foxhoven a couple of weeks ago. He was confirmed, but a number of Democrats voted against. This week, the Senate confirmations continue, and two of the governor's appointments failed confirmation. Catherine Ashe's confirmation to be on the Iowa Board of Medicine failed, with 18 Democrats voting no. Senator Janet Peterson says Ashes wrote comments on a Catholic blog agreeing with statements criticizing a movement in the church to accept gays and lesbians.
Our caucus is interested in making sure that anyone appointed to the Board of Medicine will protect the health of all Iowans. And after doing some research, there were some concerns, red flags, that caused pause in moving that confirmation forward.
But Senator Brad Zahn says one post on a blog shouldn't be enough to derail Ashes.
What frustrates me is I know what we're talking about here. Nobody wants to talk about it. She actually made a comment on a blog. One comment. So we bring her down and her whole family down. I've talked about what they've done. This is an incredible family, and I'm disgusted about what's happened. Freedom of speech only works on this side of the aisle. You do not let us or someone like her have freedom of speech, and it disgusts me.
Also failing to be confirmed is the chair of the Iowa Public Employment Relations Board, also called the PER Board. After being on the job for 4 years, a person needs to be reappointed, and that's the case for Board Chair Mike Cormack. Democrats criticized the PER Board for its role in executing a phone registration voting system for unions to recertify after changes to Iowa's collective bargaining laws began last year. Part of the new collective bargaining law is to require unions to recertify. If a member doesn't vote, it counts as a no vote. Senator Tony Bisignano says this voting process, developed from the Iowa Public Employment Relations Board, is convoluted and designed to make union members less likely to complete a vote.
But yet we put another obstacle in front of the employees' union to try to break them a little faster.
Bisignano is critical of PER Board's chair, Mike Cormack.
And I urge my colleagues here to not confirm Mr. Cormack, nor will we confirm anyone from the PER Board until we have an opportunity to make the law fair.
Cormack did not receive two-thirds of the Senate votes and is not confirmed. His job ends May 1st, and Governor Reynolds needs to appoint someone else in the next 60 days. The other two members of the PER Board were not up for confirmation this year. This is Under the Golden Dome, a weekly podcast about the legislative session. I'm John Pimble. Both chambers have passed a bill that would stop a school from drawing attention to children who don't have a lunch ticket with money in their account. In the past, some schools have dumped a child's lunch in the garbage or forced them to sit at another table with a different meal. Representative Ruth Ann Gaines is a supporter of the bill.
It has the focus of eliminating food shaming from our K through 12 population. Kids need the opportunity to eat a healthy lunch without feeling that they are unworthy.
We're one or two shows away from ending this year's series. Next week is when the legislature could end. We'll definitely have a show posted by Friday, and possibly one more after that. It depends how long the session goes and what they do. Thanks to so many people for helping me out with this show. This includes State House reporter Joyce Russell. We also get help from Katarina Sestarik. Also, our talk show producers, Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. We also have a lot of help from Radio Iowa's Kay Henderson. Katherine Perkins is the news program director. Michael Leland is our news director. What happened during this General Assembly over the last 2 years? Well, we have a couple dozen shows dating back to 2017, and you can listen to them at iowapublicradio.org, the IPR app, and through a podcast subscription with programs like iTunes. Under the Golden Dome is a production of Iowa Public Radio.